This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Chris Bilton, who is one of the co-authors of Creativities, the what, how, where, who, and why of the creative process. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, nice to be here.
To start us off, this is a great book, both in terms of its kind of academic analysis, but also in terms of its practical insights into how to be creative and how the creative process works. And I'm interested in how you got kind of inspired to write the book and what the sort of process of working together with the other co-authors was.
Well, Steve and I had written a book together and we'd also edited a book together. And that was as far back as 2014. I had the idea of doing something about multiple creativities. You know, there isn't just one type of creativity, there's lots of ways to be creative. And we were kind of kicking that around in different formats for a while. It was going to be pathways to creativity. We had this idea of a museum with different exhibits of different sorts of creativity in it. And it was sort of going back and forth. We switched publishers. We did some workshops. And through one of those workshops, we met our third co-author, DT. And she sort of introduced a lot of kind of global perspectives. And she's fairly different. Me and Steve are kind of old white blokes. And she's a very experienced, senior Afro-American woman. We thought it would be really good to have her, especially in a book which is about multiple creatives, have a different perspective. And then during lockdown, we still hadn't written this book and we sort of thought, actually, let's get on with it. So in the end, Steve and I, during lockdown, he's in New Zealand, I'm in the UK, just kind of wrote it together, the bulk of it, with DT acting more like an editor, bouncing ideas back and forth during lockdown. I think the idea of it was to get away from the kind of idea of creativity being this magical holy grail that you find, that actually we've all got some form of creativity. The challenging part is how you connect that together with other people's creativities, plural. And then the recipe thing kind of kicked in from there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not in the title, but running right the way through the book is this idea, this kind of metaphor of it being a cookbook and there being kind of recipes for creativity. And I think, as you mentioned, it helps to sort of decenter this idea of you've got to be a genius or you'll never be creative. And I'm partially kind of interested in where you kind of got the metaphor from, where that came from, and then how it sort of manifests in terms of each chapter having particular examples, particular recipes for creativity.
Yeah, I mean, we were actually thinking of calling it Creativity Cookbook, and then, or Creative Cookbook, and then we realized that was going to really confuse people, and they were going to be saying, well, where's the recipe? You know, I thought it was going to be meringues and banana cake. And the metaphor was, I started from that cliche of, well, of course, there isn't a single recipe for this. And then we started thinking about how recipe books actually work, that people use recipes as a kind of inspiration for doing things in their own way. Most people don't follow recipes. They look at them and then change them and customize them and so on. And that seemed quite a good metaphor for what we wanted readers to do. So we set that up as a kind of a way of organizing the book. And then what happened during the writing of the book, we shifted away to this what, how, where, who, why framework instead. So what you have, possibly slightly confusingly, is you have a residue of cooking metaphors. You know, originally the chapters were going to be called things like the kitchen, the dining room, the takeout, the market. And quite a lot of those metaphors are still in there, like mixing things up and going to the market to buy ingredients. But I think, you know, I think Steve and I probably both have a tendency to use metaphors a bit too much and get a bit carried away. And so I think it was partly DT and the editor and the publishers were sort of reining us back in a little bit and saying, well, let's not get too carried away. But the other thing with the recipes was that we both, Steve and I, felt that the bits we really like in books are the short little case studies. So we thought, well, let's try and build a book really around a bunch of what we're calling recipes, but are really kind of mini cases. Keep the theoretical framing relatively light. So there is theory there, but we don't kind of push it too much in order to keep the book fairly accessible. And then a bit like a recipe book, you could kind of start it wherever you wanted. You know, you could dip into the where or the why rather than starting at the beginning with the what, if that's the way that you want to read it. And famously, you know, the why chapter introduced this idea of purpose, which is intrinsic to creative processes. And it's also intrinsic to business. If you read people like Simon Sinek, who wrote the book Start With Why, which, you know, is often a kind of a thing that you're told when you're setting up an entrepreneurial venture, you know, decide your purpose. Why are you doing this first before you start worrying about what your product is? Think about your values, your purpose. And we put that at the end because we actually very often you don't really know why you're doing things until you've done them. But yeah, the kind of the what, how, who, where, why took over from the recipe, the cookbook framework a little bit, but the cookbook is still in there because, I don't know, I think we quite liked it. And the other thing is that, you know, this, as I mentioned before, this book was written during lockdown and we were spending a lot of time at home watching TV. So a lot of the recipes are inspired by stuff we were consuming, whether that's food or Netflix series. And the recipe idea again was, you know, it's something that we were kicking around between us and something we were finding sort of inspiring for ourselves to frame the book.
That's really interesting, actually. And I was particularly taken by that idea of, you know, you don't have to read it in a linear fashion. Actually, you know, you can dip in and out of the individual chapters and actually of the individual case study recipes as well. Maybe we will. I mean, you mentioned the kind of the why at the end, but maybe we'll take them sort of slightly in order. And you mentioned the kind of theory is woven sort of lightly throughout the book as well. So maybe we'll, you know, pick up on theory as and when it's relevant. But at the risk of kind of saying, what is the what? What is the how? What is the where? I wonder actually to do that, could we make it real with a couple of the case studies? So the book you mentioned, you know, is a global book and it's not just English or indeed, you know, kind of Western European or American examples. And I wonder, could you tease out the what with a couple of examples? You know, maybe we've got Royal Shakespeare Company and the Young Vic, which are obviously in Britain, but actually you've got, you know, Giacalli and Jagud, I'm not sure if I pronounced this correctly, in Nairobi and Mumbai. You've got examples of bikes in Beijing. There's examples from Louisville in the States. So could you give a sort of a flavor of a couple of examples of what the what is?
Yeah, sure. Well, the what, I mean, the starting point for the book is that we can all be creative in our own way. So then it's, well, where do we start? Well, we start with our ingredients. We start with where do ideas come from? And there's a kind of a few things around that. Firstly, looking at diversity of thought and thinking, well, where do you get different ideas from? How do you expose yourself to different ideas? So, yeah, it's very important that the recipes were global in scope and that we didn't sort of pick from the same basket, that we tried to think about, not always the usual suspects. I mean, we do have people like Steve Jobs in the book, you know, but we try to kind of be a bit more counterintuitive in the examples we were using. And we look in the first chapter at ideas of diversity and scarcity and abundance. And the argument really is that excess can be a source of creativity if it's used in the right way. And we often think of excess as, you know, we have too much stuff. We've reached peak stuff. We need to move away from it. But actually, the example from the RSC was of this project they did called Such Tweet Sorrow, which a friend of mine was involved in the writing of. And by all accounts, you know, according to the theatre critics, it was a failure. You know, people didn't really like it. And this isn't Shakespeare. But just to explain what the project was, they did Romeo and Juliet on Twitter and called it Such Tweet Sorrow. And they brought in all of these subplots from different things happening in off stage, as it were. And which is somewhat true to Shakespeare's play, that, you know, lots of stuff happens off stage, letters come in and get lost, and things are happening off screen. And the excess really was the abundance was Twitter, which at the time was this new form that nobody really quite understood, and people were saying, well, Twitter's never really going to take off. This is just a flash in the pan. And nobody's really looking at the creative possibilities of it. And what happened with Twitter is that people became, as you could imagine, and it makes sense now, people became obsessed and started following characters and setting up little hashtags and communities that were tracking all the things that were happening off stage, different characters. And the challenge really for the writers was trying to almost rein it in and keep some kind of control on it. But as a creative experience, what it did was allowed the actors, the audience or users, almost free rein to do an awful lot of things that were not really in Shakespeare. And through that, develop this incredibly rich stew of lots of different elements. And it was an example really of where we often think of excess and abundance, you know, it's confusing, there's no clarity, but actually that was the joy of it. That's the joy of Twitter, you could argue as well, that people were able to just kind of dip in and out and find lots of different ways of understanding the stories. And then the other extreme from that was the idea of scarcity and we use as the example there, Jua Kali, which is the Kenyan version, which actually a friend of DT's, Vincent, introduced us to this idea of Jua Kali, which is roughly speaking a kind of DIY hacking, making the best of things. And very similar to the idea of Jugaad, which is an Indian word, which pretty much means hack. And what Jugaad and Jukali do is they're kind of in poorer developing countries, people who don't have the resources, are not doing kind of expensive R&D to develop new products. They're making do with old products and using them to solve the problem at hand rather than trying to create a prototype for something which may be useful in the future. And it was a very pragmatic idea of creativity, which has become quite influential in the rich West as well. So you've got, you know, companies now embracing things like frugal innovation. I mean, Nestle did a whole thing about frugal innovation in the UK, actually. And during lockdown, again, there was a story that caught my eye of a kid in Kenya who made a water pump out of bits of wood that his dad had left lying around to provide clean drinking water in the village. And it was just a brilliant little story. It was a little BBC short story on their website. And so we kind of built the recipe out of that. And all of the recipes sort of work like that, that we take an event or an incident or a story or a source, and then we just kind of riff on it and try to draw that out and connect it back into some of the theories that we're trying to smuggle into the book.
I mean, for the how you do this to really good effect with a very controversial and I guess a kind of a sort of a downside or a warning about both the excesses of kind of creative leadership and creative excess, but also it's good to see, I think, one of these more controversial examples in there. So this is the example of Harvey Weinstein and I guess the kind of the Me Too movement that follows. And I wonder if you could say how that sort of illustrates the how of creativity.
Yeah, well, the how of creativity is, you know, once you've got your ingredients assembled, you've got your team assembled, you've got your people, the how is really, well, how do you make it work? How do you drive that forward? So the chapter is really about leadership. How do you lead creativity? And we have these, I mean, all the way through the book, there is this kind of idea of by association, opposition, bridging between differences. So, you know, between excess and frugality, between between rationality and spontaneity. And in this chapter, it's the idea of the kind of very rational leader who has a very clear sense of direction and is really kind of sifting the ingredients, measuring things, aligning things. And we use some examples of that from things like football teams. We talk about Marco Bielsa, actually, which is always the kiss of death whenever we mention any football team. They implode and he got sacked while the book was in the proofing stage. But there you go. And then the other side alongside that, that kind of sifting is the more energetic mixing, where you just want to get energy and power and drive behind it. And the example we used there was the show South Park, where everything is done incredibly quickly and they turn these shows around within a week, which is incredible when you compare that to shows like The Simpsons, which, you know, take weeks and months to produce. Anyway, the Weinstein example was, as you say, an example of excess. What happens when you take these bisociative opposites and you push towards one extreme? And in Weinstein's case, the extreme was towards an extreme version of that energetic mixing and drive and energy. And he was a sort of force of nature. Meryl Streep famously and possibly regrettably referred to him as God in one of her Oscar acceptance speeches. You know, he was loved and he was feted by Hollywood. But of course, what that disguised was that when you have that much drive and energy, it has a number of negative consequences. One of which is that you squeeze the energy out of everybody else and you become this kind of dominant personality who squashes the initiative and the creativity out of the people around you whilst, you know, drawing all the focus onto yourself. And, you know, one of the things that came out of Me Too was, well, look at all these amazing women directors, writers, actresses whose creativity has just been blanked and squeezed out by men like Weinstein. And you know, obviously he wasn't, we demonize him as an individual, but it was more of a culture than an individual. And the other kind of thing that happens with somebody like Weinstein is that they become attributed, as with the Meryl Streep calling him God, with this sort of genius idea that they are indispensable and that they are the only person that can make this happen, which, you know, is obviously the antithesis to the argument we're trying to present in the book, but also leads to the whole lack of accountability. You know, that if creativity is simply a matter of magical genius and you have a magician, then you don't want to touch the magician. You let them do their thing, regardless of what it costs, regardless of the human cost. And you get versions of that all the way through the creative sector, all the way through business. You know, people who are attributed with this almost divine power and therefore getting a free pass to do anything they want, to get away with everything. And you know, with Weinstein, that was the kind of eventually that came out in the wash. But that there's still that culture of genius in the film industry, especially partly because people still have the idea that the film industry is so unpredictable and so uncertain that the only people who get it right are these kind of one-off maverick geniuses. Actually, the film industry is quite a lot more rational than that, and they do, you know, they use data analytics, and Netflix, if nothing else, have shown us that way of working is just as good at divining future hits as the kind of genius in the top floor. So yeah, that's Weinstein, and he was, you know, it's good in a book like this to give some negative examples rather than saying, well, here's a great recipe, here's an inspiring thing to do. We wanted to have a few which were, well, here's something that really didn't work, and you know, don't do this.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, exactly that, actually. And, you know, it sort of pierces some of the overly sort of celebratory discourses around creativity that we see in some of the kind of, you know, government policy, but also in bits of management textbooks as well. And I suppose actually that kind of idea about bringing management theory in is what you do in the Where chapter. And I don't want to sort of drill down too much, and readers can explore it for themselves. But I'm interested if you could give a sort of a flavor, an overview of what's going on with the Where chapter, because you've got, I guess, quite a diverse range of organizations and individuals, and quite a strong engagement with kind of organizational form and organizational theory. And I'm interested to know kind of what you were trying to do with the Where chapter as much as what's actually going on with it.
Yeah. Well, I think that the Where chapter was, you know, if the previous chapter was about leadership, this is really about organization and organizational structures and systems, as you say. And I think, again, in the spirit of that there's no one clear recipe, the framework is quite loose. And really it says, well, you know, you've got big organizations, you've got small organizations, you've got kind of very controlling bureaucratic organizations, you've got very free and individualistic organizations. And let's look at how these different things work. And what we, I think, tried to show was that the distinctions are not as clear cut as you might think, and we, you know, we include examples of overlapping forms that kind of cross, that hybridize between different ways of organizing. But you know, you've got what we call an M type organization, like Toyota, which is this, you know, classic corporate controlling structure, but actually within that allows a certain level of freedom because you're able to leverage different capabilities within a big company like that to do quite innovative things. And then we go from that into a company like Walt Disney, which is where it was, again, a kind of corporate organization, but that there was a Disney's approach, Walt's approach, was to kind of delegate and outsource and to get other people to have the ideas. And that, you know, that bleeds into the next chapter, the Who chapter as well. But it's the idea that organizations can be, even though they are structured in superficially similar ways, can produce very different outcomes. And then we jump to the sort of more individualistic organizations from Factory Records, and we included the Tiger King. This was, I blame Steve for this, as a sort of analogy between the Tiger King and Steve Jobs. Both maverick, heroic, creative leaders who kind of inspire awe and fear in those around them, and are a bit like Weinstein, are allowed to do things in their own way, and perhaps to the detriment of those around them. But in the case of Jobs and in particular, you know, have obviously been able to empower and enable. And that's one of the weird paradoxes of Steve Jobs, that he's notoriously was a bully and, you know, a dominant personality, but at the same time seemed to be able to get people at Apple, and indeed Apple users, to feel like they were creative too, and empower them and enable them in some way, which is, you know, I mean, we're kind of interested in these sort of paradoxes all through the book, because creativity is, as you know, is a paradoxical thing.
I mean, what, one of the examples from the Who chapter is quite nice. Illustration of that, and I was really taken with the discussion of Tower Records in Japan. You know, on the one hand, you've got effectively the kind of collapse of this business in the United States, and you know, it's almost kind of obsolescence, and yet in Japan it's, you know, a kind of a triumph, and is somewhat of a sort of, like, you know, iconic cultural destination as much as it is a thriving business. So how does that illustrate the kind of the shift away from, you know, single creative geniuses, but also still keeps Who as important?
With Tower, it's Tower Records in Japan. I mean, the first thing to say about Tower Records in Japan, in a way, is that there was a lot of circumstantial things that made it work, which is partly to do with Japanese culture. And I don't know whether you've been to Japan. I haven't, but it's...
I've been to Tower Records in Japan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned it as a cultural destination.
Right. Well, it's on my visit list, along with Third Man Record, which is another one that we refer to, who've now just opened a branch in London, actually, of Third Man. But with Tower Records, it was the story of the Who was that it was it we start with the Mark Twain thing about getting somebody else to paint your fence, getting other people to do the work. And what Tower Records did was it enabled the workforce and the fans, the users, to get very involved in the business. And so whilst the rest, as you say, whilst Tower Records went down the toilet, Tower Records Japan was bought out and operated independently, and was able to engage their users through in-store events, through magazines, through live, all the kind of live stuff, all the collectible vinyl stuff, all the stuff that actually now the music industry is really trying to take advantage of. And so in many ways, they were sort of ahead of their time in what they were doing. But the Who chapter is really about the shift away from the idea of one person or one group of people being in control to kind of conceding power outwards. And so a lot of the chapter is describing decisions by organizations, by either people who run an organization or people who hold rights over creative products, to allow people, their users or other people outside the organization, to play around with what they've got. And that's a big risk, and it's a sort of concession of control that can backfire. But in the case of Tower Records Japan, it allows them to actually produce something, yeah, really unique, and a thing that people from the UK like you will go and visit as something that could be a template for the music industry worldwide. And, you know, you do wonder sometimes, you know, what would happen if you were if you were still standing as a record store in the UK or in the US now, because they all went pretty much. I mean, even, you know, HMV, I suppose, staggered on a little while, but they kind of merged, and they lost their focus on music, and they did that thing of diversifying into other forms rather than diversifying into other people, which is what Tower Records Japan did.
The final chapter, I guess, kind of extends that what do we do question. So you talk about why in sort of various different ways, but one of the things that happens in, I guess, the kind of second half of the final chapter is that you talk about the existential kind of crisis moment for organizations or for projects when they get to a point where they're kind of asking, well, why are we doing this? Why are we still doing this? What is this for? And actually talking about, you know, things like Tower's success and other record companies' failures is a good illustration of that. And I wonder if you could sort of, as we wrap up, think through that existential question of why for me, because I suppose a lot of discourse in this space is how do we get something started? There's very little that tends to grapple with the what happens when it's successful, where do we go next?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that the start with the why. I was actually on a train last night, and by weird serendipity, somebody was sitting opposite me reading Start With Why. And it's an incredibly influential idea in business that you start with purpose. And it's, as you say, it's all about the startups, never about, well, what happens when you get pissed off and you get bored. And, you know, we use the example of the Beatles, you know, who they change, and you think, well, you know, they've had their time and they don't want to carry on doing what they're doing. They don't want to go and do live tours anymore. And I think that that's often presented as a kind of, it's a failure, it's a dropout. But it's a much more interesting time to ask the question why is the sort of, well, what next? What are we doing? What's the point of all this? Why have I wasted my time or our time doing this thing that I thought was really important and now I can't really be asked with anymore? And that kind of self-questioning, I think, was what we wanted to get to in that chapter, and looking at what happens when the business moves on and leaves you behind, or when you move on and leave the business behind. Those are the kind of the two pathways that we track really in the chapter. And, you know, there's the example of Ben and Jerry's, which, you know, at least in the in our telling of the story, is that these guys didn't really know what they were doing. You know, they were just mucking about, and they were college dropouts. They weren't even planning to make ice cream. They were planning to, I can't even remember what it was now, cakes or I don't know, whatever it was. And they couldn't afford the equipment, and the ice cream equipment was going cheap. So we'll buy that. The whole business was a series of accidents, but through the process of running the business, I think it was Ben got bored and said he was fed up. And somebody said, well, why don't you try and make it into something that you care about and introduce some of your values? So he said, oh, that's a good idea. So then they had this sort of social mission, which, you know, Ben and Jerry's has been associated with. And it, you know, it was things like using ex-offenders or a company that sourced chocolate brown is made by ex-offenders, contributing to social causes, social justice, all of these things. Now, in one version of the story, you've got Ben and Jerry's idealistic entrepreneur taken over by evil corporation, Unilever, sellout, failure. Actually, the social mission was not the thing, was not the why of the business. It wasn't why they started. They didn't have a why. They stumbled upon it. And strangely, when Unilever took over, they actually maintained that social mission as part of a Unilever brand. And Ben and Jerry were kind of tolerated on the board as to carry on. So it was an interesting parting of the ways between the individual personal why and the business productional why. And it being quite a sort of benign handover, really. From one time kind of why to another. But then some of the others are more tragic tales, really, of people who've held on too long, or who've been where the productional why, the logic of the business has sort of forced them to suppress their own personality. And, you know, we include the sort of story of Maradona in that as an example of what happens when the why, the question of why being asked by people around Maradona doesn't really allow him to express himself, and he becomes kind of trapped in this myth of Maradona, and he can no longer be Diego anymore. I think one of the other stories of the why is the Papi Jiang, who's this I guess you probably these days you'd call her an online influencer, but you know, back in the day she was quite an outlier in doing what she did. And she made these kind of funny videos. She was an ex-actress. She was quite different from the other sorts of people in China who were doing this kind of thing, in that she was quite a bit older. She, according to her, at least, she wasn't conventionally pretty. She was just an ordinary girl next door type. I mean, I think that was quite clever on her part to play with that. But what became clear with her is that she was not really taking it very seriously. She got given the big sponsorship deals and she would just say, I don't need the money, give it to somebody else. And when I talked to some of my Chinese students about Papi Zhang, they said, well, you know, she was a failure, really. She failed to kind of take advantage of all the e-commerce opportunities around her brand. But from her point of view, she was just doing what she wanted to do. So compared to, again, looking at this parting of the ways between the personal and the productional why, in her case, it was all about self-expression, self-fulfillment, and the business side of it, she didn't really care that much about. She happened to be very good at it. She built a big brand, but then pretty much let it wither away, because that's what she cared about. So I think these sort of mid-career, you know, we're at that time of life, you know, mid-career crises where you think, well, why am I doing this? What's the point of this? I think those can be very fruitful and can allow you to separate out from what you were doing before and do something different. And that's, again, in the spirit of the book, is allowing people to do different things and reinvent themselves.
What does that mean in terms of your own work? I mean, it's always a bit kind of cruel when an author's finished a book and, you know, as you mentioned, the kind of circumstances of writing it under the lockdowns of 2020 and you know, the three of you working together, to then be like, so what are you doing next? But it strikes me that actually that final chapter has some interesting implications actually for your own work in terms of moving forward with research on creativity, or actually doing something completely different in terms of finding a new challenge.
Well, I've just written a book about cultural management, which is coming out probably this year. It's one of those very short books. I'm a big fan of the short book, actually, Dave. I like short books, both as a writer and a reader. So there's that. But that, in a way, again, is a bit of a throwback to things that I was writing about kind of 15 years ago about management of organisations and creative organisations. I'm working with colleagues at Warwick, Dave Wright and international colleagues, Borda Klepp and Mika Pikkanen, on looking at creative work. And this was a thing that I know that you've done a lot of work on. But we're interested in, particularly in the relationship between productive and unproductive time, and how the sort of unproductive wasted time is often the very important part of a creative process, and it's the one bit that you never get paid for. And what happened during lockdown is that mismatch became really exposed, and you had people who could no longer afford to indulge engaging in that creative process and left the profession. And so you've got this, you know, there's a crisis now of people leaving the profession, and also, as I think your research has proved, you know, that very, very hard for people to get into the creative industries who don't have privileged access to sources of funding and sources of time that allow them that creative scope. So thinking about creative work from that point of view, and trying to think about how could you make things fairer, better, would be important. I think the other side of where I'm seeing my own work going is I'm very driven by the stuff that I'm teaching to my students and things that I think will be useful to them. And so I think that's why I like short books as well. And things that, you know, certainly with a book like Creativity, is where you can lift bits of it out and use it in a teaching context. You know, there's a session here, if you want it, about motivational theory and creativity. There's a section here about definitions of creativity and what does creativity mean. And so, you know, trying to find that connection between things that you're going to be teaching that students are going to find useful and things that inspire you and that drive you forward. That's probably where my why comes from, I guess.